I remember my first boss at Harris Associates saying to me, when you make an investment, you're getting two things, the balance sheet and the guy who runs the company, and you better like both of them.
And the explanation cannot be found in any mathematics, but it has to be found in investor psychology.
You know, the game in our kind of life is being able to recognize a good idea when you rarely get it. What is the old saying? That opportunity comes to the prepared mind.
Human nature hasn't changed a lot in 25,000 years. I think volatility is terrific.
Lose money for the firm and I will be understanding. Lose a shred of reputation for the firm and I will be ruthless.
Welcome to AUM. On this show, we dive into the process, strategy, methods, and lessons from some of the world's best asset managers. We explore what it takes to produce outstanding investment outcomes in the complex adaptive system that is modern markets. I'm your host, Ryan Henderson, and today I have the absolute pleasure of being joined by Bill Nygren. Bill is a portfolio manager of the Oakmark Select Fund, the Oakmark Fund, and the Oakmark U.S. Large Cap ETF. Bill is also the Chief Investment Officer U.S. at Harris Associates and has received tons of investment accolades over the years, including being named Morningstar's Domestic Stock Manager of the Year in 2001. Bill, it's an honor. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
Let's kick things off with, I guess, the genesis of your career. Do you remember when you first kind of discovered that you had a passion for investing?
I would say I first discovered that I wanted to have an investing career probably in high school. And it largely came from watching Lou Rukeyser's Wall Street Week on PBS every Friday night at 7:30. It's funny, we get so used to 24/7 financial news today to think that 50 years ago, stock market news was pretty much contained in that one half hour and one half hour a week. And I loved hearing from the different guests on there, the ones who talked about long-term investing and doing things when they were out of favor always resonated the most with me because that was most consistent with the way I'd been raised as a consumer. I grew up in a middle-class family. We were always trying to stretch our dollars. And even as a little kid getting dragged grocery shopping with my mom, you know, we'd hit two or three different grocery stores to take advantage of the weekly specials. And if nobody had cherries on sale that week, we had a lot of grapes. And then the next week when cherries were on sale, you know, they'd be part of every meal. So when I ran into people on the investing side who took that same approach of buy what's on sale and be patient and wait for other opportunities if it's not on sale, that it made sense to me. And I then, you know, read most of the books that were in our public library on the topic of investing. That's not as heroic as it sounds today, as there are so many books on investing. But it, in the small library of a suburban Minnesota city that I lived in, it was probably one shelf, maybe 30 or 40 books. And there too, the ones that talked about like a Graham or a Buffett approach to investing resonated with me. So then I planned my college curriculum around trying to learn what I thought was important to be in the investment business. To me, it only made sense if you wanted to be an investor that you'd understand accounting. To me, it's the language of investing. When I hear kids tell me today that they want to be in the investment business, but they hate accounting and they don't want to take any accounting, that sounds as illogical as if they said, I want to spend my life in Spain, but I don't really want to bother with the language. So I learned accounting as an undergraduate. I took accounting internships and then went to the University of Wisconsin because of their applied securities analysis program. That was a program where a group of students got to manage an actual real money portfolio. I think we had about $150,000 to invest. Brokerage firms donated research. So the experience was about as close as you could get as a student to what it would really be like managing real-world money. Just a couple other anecdotes. As a senior at the University of Minnesota, I was taking an entrepreneurism course. And as our final exam, we had to present to the class if we were going to start a business, what it would be. And mine was that I would start a mutual fund. And when I said that all I would need to be successful was to get people to invest $25 million in it, because that would give me fees of about $250,000, half to cover expenses, and then half could be my salary, I literally got laughed out of the room. So just like Michael Jordan uses those insults throughout his early career to propel his desire to succeed, I still think back on that day and how embarrassing it was that nobody believed me that anyone in their right mind would give me $25 million to manage. And his Oakmark Fund alone has crossed the $25 billion mark in the past year. That becomes more funny than something to be angry about. And then the last thing I'd say is, even though I didn't know until like high school that I wanted my career to be in investing, as I look back on some earlier experiences in my life, I think you could see the seeds were being planted. In 1964, so I would have been 6 years old, the U.S. Mint stopped making silver coins because the silver in the coins was worth more than 25 cents. And people were melting down silver coins and then selling them as silver. And so starting in 1965, the coins came out and they're basically worthless as a metal, but the old ones were still in circulation. One of my grandpas was a milk truck driver, and he would have to make his own collections as he delivered the milk. And he would come home with a big bag of change. And he and I would sort through them to find the silver dimes and quarters. And then I could replace them with the new money and then sell those off to, you know, the silver shops that were paying three or four times face value for those coins. So, you know, if you think about that today as like arbitrage, I think you could see the seeds were planted pretty early.
Yeah, some early bargain hunting experience there. At what point did you get connected with Harris Associates, and how did that connection happen?
Yeah, so it's a pretty funny story. I ended up, after the University of Wisconsin's Applied Securities Analysis program, I ended up working at an insurance company, and it was a very small investment team. And I would say two lessons I learned very quickly there were, one, if you're going to be a valuable analyst, you have to have the same investment philosophy as the portfolio managers who are making the decisions on your investments. I would end up looking for sell reports, that stocks that were way down, and then try to find an argument of why business value might be significantly more than current results looked like they'd be worth. My bosses, the portfolio managers, liked to wait until there were two sell-side buy reports out on the company before they would consider buying it. So I remember an early story there. I had recommended Allied Stores. It was a kind of a struggling department store chain, but they owned the Brooks Brothers specialty stores. And the argument was that Brooks Brothers plus the real estate value and accounts receivable value, because back then the department stores all had their own credit card operations. So the argument was those three pieces got you about three times the current stock price, because it was out of favor. The department stores weren't performing well. And it was almost a year after I had recommended that my bosses came back to me, and the stock had moved from like 17 to 40. And there are a number of buy reports on it. And they told me they were getting pretty interested. Could I refresh myself on it and represent it? And in my representation, it's like, you know, the stock's at 40. I think it's worth about 45. Really not interested anymore. And we were like two ships passing in the night. You know, I was putting out what I thought was high quality work, but it was absolutely useless to them. So I was not succeeding as an analyst in that organization. So I was thinking at my next stop, I want to be at a firm where investment results drives their success or failure. So I decided there that I needed to be at a firm where everyone at the company was on the same page about what we were looking for in an investment. And I wanted a long-term time horizon, buying what was out of favor, patiently waiting for the rest of the world to see the value that we were early identifying. The other lesson is about how important the investment results are for the success or failure of the organization. I was at an insurance company, and I got a call one day. I'd been there about a year and a half, and it was the CFO of the company saying, "I've got really great news for you. You've been selected to be part of our management training program. And, you know, we want to take you out of the common stock department and give you exposure to all these other areas in finance that matter to the insurance company to better train you to become a finance executive here." And I had no political savvy at that point in my life. I was probably 23 years old. And my answer was, "I don't think you understand. I'm a common stock analyst who happens to work at an insurance company, not an insurance company executive who happens to work in the common stock department." So sleeping on that, I realized that I'd probably really shot myself in the foot and career prospects didn't look that good. So I called up the professor of the applied securities program, Steve Hawk, and told him that I didn't think there was a long-term fit here. And these are the two things I'm really looking for. Investments drive success or failure of the organization, and they really have a strong commitment to value investing. And will you let me know if anything crosses your desk of someone looking for that? He's like, "Don't have anything now, but I'll give you a call." And it was like a month later, my phone rings and I'm at a cubicle. So, you know, there's no privacy whatsoever. And I say, you know, "Hello." And it's, "Bill, this is Steve Hawk. You're going to get a call in just a minute from an alumni you don't know, Clyde McGregor, who works at a firm you've never heard of, Harris Associates. They're in Chicago. You should take the job. I have to hang up now because he's going to be calling." And I'm like, "Okay," hang up the phone. It rings. It's Clyde. You know, Clyde and I worked together here for 40 years. He managed our equity and income fund. The interviews I had here, all the stocks that I'd been thinking about buying because they looked so cheap or thinking about recommending. The people I talked to here, you'd get that smile of like, "Yeah, we've been working on it too." And you know, what was supposed to be like a half hour interview would turn into an hour discussion about pluses and minuses of the company. And I knew after, you know, an hour of interviews here that this is where I wanted to work. At the time, I thought, I at least know the next 3 to 5 years, I'm going to learn a lot from these people. I had no concept that 42 years later, I would still be at that same company and loving the job every bit as much as I did the first day.
And so if I have the timing right, I believe that was around 1983 when you started at Harris.
Yep.
A lot has changed since that point in time. Financial data is more readily available to everyone. So I think a lot of people would think finding undervalued securities is maybe easier today. Do you think the skills that are required to be a good value investor have changed at all?
That's a really tough question. I think there's a psychology to being a value investor that has not changed at all. That if you're going to be successful as a value investor, you need to be comfortable taking contrary positions. You know, value investors almost tend to get nervous when too many people agree with them, whereas most people like the comfort of being in the crowd. So being able to say, I think the world is wrong. And if you're patient and wait a few years, I think we'll be able to see that. That part was the same 40 years ago as it is today. I think what's changed is trying to estimate what a business is worth has become more complicated. 40 years ago, returns of businesses were much more tied to physical assets. So it was easier to say, if a company's got a $30 book value, they'll probably earn somewhere around 15% on that. Some number of years out, $4 to $5 a share of earnings is a pretty reasonable projection. The world we live in today, the returns are much more tied to intangibles. So it's harder to just look at a book value number and say 5 years from now, they should earn X percent on equity. So I think it requires today an ability, more of an ability, to understand how a business works, analyze its competitive situation, and make informed estimates of what the company may look like 5 years down the road.
Yeah, that makes sense. How it's the art of value investing is still similar, the intellectual kind of curiosity and passion that's required to be successful, but how to value those securities has maybe changed a little bit. I want to dig in a little bit to the Harris Oakmark actual investment process and how you guys search for value. I guess the best place to start would maybe be the Tuesday meetings. So for anyone that is unfamiliar with your guys' process, what are the Tuesday meetings and what are the goals of them?
Sure. So our U.S. investment team is probably four or five of us that primarily manage portfolios and another dozen to 15 investment professionals who are primarily analysts. And they're all generalists. They look for ideas that they believe meet our criteria, which is large discount to intrinsic business value, value that grows at least as fast as the market, and management that's aligned with the outside shareholders. That last point is especially important because of our very long time horizon. I remember my first boss at Harris Associates saying to me, when you make an investment, you're getting two things, the balance sheet and the guy who runs the company, and you better like both of them. And so you can see we've tweaked our process over 40 years, but it's still primarily the same. So these generalist analysts will look for ideas anywhere, you know, anywhere they think they can see attractive opportunities. So they could look at an auto company one day, an oil and gas company another, a packaged goods company. We don't do things by industry silos the way the rest of the industry does. Our belief is because our criteria are so well defined of the type of company we want to invest in, we would rather our analysts then have the ability to look across industries to find those opportunities. When they find something, they write up a buy report. For us, that's maybe a 2 or 3 page written report outlining why they believe it meets our investment criteria. There'll be a bunch of standard attachments to that, an earnings model, buy and sell targets, and that report gets distributed to us late Monday morning. And most of us try to keep our calendars free on Monday afternoons so that we can try to find any flaws in the argument. Our Tuesday morning meetings, all of our new ideas get presented at that meeting in front of the entire domestic investment team. So envision a long table, roughly 20 of us seated at the table. And you know, if you're presenting General Motors, the person at the end of the table will say, our first item today is Ryan is going to pitch General Motors. You now give a 60-second summary of why you think the stock should be purchased. And then for the next half hour, the 19 other people at the table try to tell you why you might be missing something and why it could be wrong. The goal of the meeting is that we identify as many of our mistakes as possible before we lose any client dollars on them. And it's an intimidating meeting. It's really smart people sitting around the table who are all seemingly disagreeing with you. And at the end of that half hour or so discussion, three of our senior investment people will vote on whether or not they believe the stock should be eligible for our portfolio managers to purchase. And it's a rigorous process. Some people are surprised that even the most experienced of our portfolio managers can't just put a stock in the portfolio that they think is attractive. It has to go through that same process. Two of the three people voting yes puts the stock on the approved list, and then it's eligible for purchase. And as contentious as those meetings might be, typically at the end of a Monday meeting, the whole group of us are sitting together at the lunch table and, you know, might be talking about the election or the Cubs or a movie we saw, or did you notice what Berkshire just bought? We can look like we're fighting really intensely, but it's kind of like sibling rivalry where, you know, you can fight really hard, but then you're a team against any outside influences. And I think that's a big part of what's worked so well for us for these 40 some years is we can really attack each other on intellectual arguments and attack the argument and not the individual. And at the end of that argument, nobody's going back to their office and slamming the door. It's like they understand it's our job to try and find mistakes. And if you're the analyst presenting and you've made a mistake, you'd much rather it gets noticed there than after you buy the stock and 3 years later it's down 30%.
Makes sense. Yeah, it sounds a bit like intellectual tension by design. Do you think that forces the analysts to sort of be more prepared when they come in for that presentation, knowing that there's going to be all those devil's advocates?
No question. So much so that we decided, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, that to try to create that same level of tension and preparedness in the analyst, that we would do a devil's advocate review annually on our top holdings, forcing someone to basically take the position of, I'd rather short this stock than be long it, and go through the arguments, because we were finding that the analysts that were really sharp on their ideas when they were brand new weren't quite as sharp 3 years in, because there wasn't the pressure to know that somebody was going to be taking the other side of the argument with you anytime you talked about the stock. So that's also part of our Tuesday meetings now, that we try once a year on our top 25 holdings to effectively have someone argue the short side, and we'll go through the arguments. Typically, the stocks stay on our approved list after that, but we tend to have a much, much clearer idea of where we differ from the rest of the world and kind of the signposts to be watching for to see if our thesis is playing out or not.
That makes sense. How many ideas do you expect an analyst to come up with per year?
I would say it's easiest to work backwards on this. We think for our process to work well, we need to see about 50 new ideas a year. Two-thirds of those get onto our approved list. Our approved list is about 100 names, and that gives us cycling through the names and the freshening of the approved list at about an appropriate pace. I said earlier we have about 15 investment professionals that are primarily analysts. So if you divide 50 by 15, you would get 3 to 4 new ideas a year per analyst. And I think that's about the average pace. We have some analysts that do a little more than that, some that do a little less. And if they do more on new ideas, then they tend to do less on devil's advocate reviews or, you know, other ways that they're helping the team.
Does it feel like for the analyst, more time is spent on those new ideas, or is it more maintenance research?
I think for a typical analyst, it's probably a relatively even split of their time. You spend more time on a new idea than you do an update of a company that you've held for years. But the analyst who has 3 or 4 new ideas probably has 2 to 3 times that many that are on our approved list. So they're doing the number of projects. They're more maintenance projects than there are new ideas, but the new ideas take a longer amount of time.
Okay.
And one thing that we've actively tried to fight is the typical path in an organization is you come in, join a research team, and you've got nothing on your coverage list. So all of your time is available for new idea work. And the more successful you've been at new ideas, your maintenance list becomes larger and it crowds out new idea time. So we actively transfer names from analysts who have followed them for a few years to younger analysts so that we continue to have free time for our most experienced analysts to spend on new idea production. That we're fighting that natural trend that work on the existing names ends up eating up their whole day.
So what does the process look like after, let's say an idea has been presented by an analyst, it gets 2 out of the 3 votes, and it's added to the approved list. What's the process then from there? Is it up to you and the other portfolio managers to decide what the position sizing would be? Does it automatically get added to a portfolio, or is it kind of wait and see?
So I'll use Oakmark Fund as an example. So Bobby Birig, Mike Nicholas, and I are the 3 co-managers on the fund, and we are truly co-managers. It's not like I'm senior manager and they're junior underneath me. The 3 of us have equal votes as to what goes into the portfolio, what goes out of the portfolio, what position sizes we want. We all office on the same floor. It's one of the advantages of having one office. You know, we're all here together. So when a new idea gets presented, the 3 of us will talk about it. Occasionally, we'll immediately decide to add it to the portfolio. But typically, it will be, we kind of like the idea, but we have a handful more questions. Next day or two, we'll work with the analyst to get those questions answered. And then the 3 of us will vote. And if 2 of us think it belongs in the portfolio, it will go into the portfolio. In the Oakmark Fund, we tend to own about 55 names on average. Portfolio usually has about 5% cash. So if you say 95 divided by 55, average positions about 1.6%. We'll typically start a little bit smaller than that. As we gain comfort, move it up toward a normal position. And if we get to a point of saying we have more comfort in this than a typical name, then it will rise to the top names in the portfolio. Given that we want the Oakmark Fund to be a fund that an investor could use as one-stop shopping, we don't want any one name to be too large a percentage of the portfolio. So we cap out our largest positions at about 4% of the portfolio, which ironically means we aren't willing to take as much risk today as the S&P 500 is.
Yeah, there's quite the concentration at the top there for the S&P 500 right now. What about on the flip side? So after you have, deemed an investment a mistake, you guys have what is called, I believe, the mistake management protocol.
I know, it makes it sound really important.
What is it, and how do you think it helps the team?
So I think one of the biggest problems with value investing is you've got this continuum of patience, which you need, and stubbornness, which will kill you. And where you sit on that continuum can determine how successful you are as a value investor. And what we want is we want to be very patient if a business is doing what we expected it would do, but the stock price isn't. So, you know, company performing like we thought it would, stock down 20%. That's great. We don't even consider that a mistake. That's an opportunity to buy more of something that's become more attractive. We define our mistakes as fundamentals not performing in the pattern that was consistent with our thesis. And when we see a company, call it 10% or get report results, maybe 10% below what we anticipated they would, then we look at it and say, we've made a mistake. And the typical value investor response is to say, Well, yep, that was a bad quarter, but the stock's down 15%. The business value is only down 10%. It's really cheaper today than it was yesterday. And we've studied enough of our own data to know that when we do that, we're wrong as often as we're right, if not more often. So we want the path of least resistance to be to say that if we've made a mistake on the fundamentals, that we make it easy to sell that company. I think sometimes you fall into the trap of saying, just like when you're ready to purchase, you might say, I don't think I know enough about this to buy it. And then once you own it, you say, I don't think I know enough to sell it. I think that's a big, big, big mistake. If you don't know enough to buy it today, it shouldn't be in the portfolio. So we try to step up the pressure on the analyst to either acknowledge the mistake or to say, I'm just as comfortable with this idea as I and would present it as a new idea today. So that's kind of what happens after the first mistake. If it falls short again, then we typically have an automatic devil's advocate review, vote at the end of that as to whether or not the stock should stay on the list. If it falls short again, we look at the idea of should we change analysts? And there'd be two reasons to do that. One, you worry that the original analyst has become anchored to their original thesis and isn't reacting as much as they should to new news. So in the case that you're wrong, you're worried the new analyst isn't going to acknowledge it. But there's just as big a problem if you're right, because after the analyst has kind of taken three swings and a miss, or three swings, three misses, they kind of lose their voice. And they're going like this, saying that you should buy the stock, and you aren't really hearing anything because you've lost confidence in that individual's ability to assess this specific stock. And we found if we transfer the name, that the new analyst has got a more ready audience than the old analyst would, saying, I know I've screwed this up three times, but I'm pretty sure I'm right this time.
Interesting. Yeah, it sounds like you guys do a pretty good job trying to fight sort of some of the bad behavioral tendencies that can lead to not so great investment outcomes. I guess
I do think one of the great things about Harris Associates is, right or wrong, there's a ton of intellectual honesty. And, you know, there's a tendency in this profession to pretend we know more than we know, to pretend we don't make as many mistakes as we do. And I do think at Harris, we've done a pretty good job of fighting that, acknowledging that the sooner we admit mistakes, the less costly they are. And there's not only a personal benefit to that, but the team benefits as well.
From the outside looking in, it feels like Harris has a very organized, streamlined sort of research and portfolio management process. Does it feel that way internally as well?
Most of the time.
There's a little bit of chaos. Hey, listeners, before we move on, I want to mention the company that actually runs this show. AUM is a FinChat podcast. FinChat.io is the fastest growing equity research platform on the internet. Powered by AI, FinChat offers institutional grade financial data on all stocks globally. And the best part is the data extends well beyond the generic financial metrics. You know all those company specific metrics that you track on your own spreadsheets? I'm talking about Amazon's segment revenue, Netflix's paying subscribers by region, Chipotle's comp sales, Uber's active customers, Spotify MAUs. FinChat tracks all of it so you don't have to. If those numbers matter to you, I recommend checking out the platform. All new users get 2 weeks free of FinChat Pro automatically. So head on over to finchat.io and check it out. Now let's get back to the interview.
The chaos can be good.
Yeah.
I mean, what you don't see from the outside is the intensity of the arguments that are going on about either portfolio holdings or things we're considering holding. And like I said, if you were a fly on the wall, you might say, like, how do these people even work together after they talk to each other like this? But we all acknowledge it's part of the process. You know, young analysts come here and they're shocked to find out my door is open and I'm actually anxious to hear their opinion, especially if they disagree with me. I don't want somebody to come in and say, wow, you're really smart to own all those bank stocks. And man, I think they're really cheap too. I want the person to come in here and say, you know, it looks kind of crazy to me that you own all of these. And here are my reasons for thinking you're not right. Again, there aren't a lot of organizations where you can go to the top people and confront them on their intellectual beliefs and really like challenge them and be treated as an equal sitting across the table. That part might appear chaotic, but again, I think it's part of the reason we've been as successful as we have been.
Yeah, benefits the team in the long run. I do want to, I guess I've got a few questions that are a little more markets, investing specific. So first one would be sort of the macro view. Does your view on the macro environment overall impact your portfolio decisions in any way?
Well, I think it has to. I mean, we look out 7 years, so we have to make sure everybody's kind of on the same page with what environment 7 years will look like. Now, I think we'd be crazy to predict that 7 years from now would be a recession, or 7 years from now would be the best time the country's ever seen. And even if we did think that, we wouldn't think that was sustainable. So for us, our 7-year macro overlay is always that the world will be normal in 7 years. It's very rare that that is enough out of consensus that it's affecting our rank ordering of stocks very much. But sometimes it is. You know, in March of 2020, when there was concern about would we ever travel again? Would COVID leave us all locked up in our houses the rest of our lives? If you said you thought the world would be normal in 7 years, anything travel related looked incredibly cheap. If in 2009, you said you thought the economy would be normal by 2016, that gave you a very pro-cyclic portfolio, because that put you at the upper echelon of positive macro forecasts. So in those extreme times, saying things will be normal in 7 years can put a tilt on your portfolio. But most of the time, saying things will be normal in 7 years is really not at all an out of consensus forecast. And the only reason we do it is just to make sure that our analysts are kind of all on the same page and we aren't messing up our rank ordering by having one analyst predict 4% GDP growth and another predict 1.
Yeah, I imagine it gives you, kind of benefits you both ways, having sort of the pragmatist view for 7 years out when things are at their worst. You can find a lot of value that way, and vice versa when things feel extreme the other way. I guess another question you've got, you can look through all the holdings in the various portfolios on the Harris Oakmark website. And I was looking through some, and it seems like a lot of the stocks are in industries that most people would maybe ignore right away, whether that's insurance, airlines, auto. I believe there was some other industries in there that people might not touch as well. First question is, are there any industries that you outright avoid?
There's nothing that we would say is off limits. Given the size of the assets we have to manage in the Oakmark Fund, we do limit ourselves to big businesses. So our investable universe is the 250 largest by sales net income or shareholders' equity. We don't like relying on market capitalization to restrict our universe. We think business fundamentals are the more important restrictor. Within that group, there's nothing that we'd say is off limits. If you think about the three criteria that we have, especially management that thinks and acts like an owner of the business, I think there are some industries that's harder to find than other industries. You know, the electric utility industry doesn't usually have entrepreneur-like leaders, and it probably wouldn't even be appropriate for that industry. So it's rare that you would see them occupy much space in our portfolios. Also, by the time they would get cheap enough for us to think they were at a big discount to business value, they'd probably have enough dividend income that they'd be attracting fixed income money. So it's another reason they don't show up much. REITs don't show up very often in our portfolios, because we find if commercial real estate people are deciding they would rather get the stock market valuation than the real estate industry valuation, it's usually because the stock market's overvaluing the assets. So it's rare, unless you're at one of those times where the market's completely walking away from real estate and it's way, way out of favor. But we, throughout our history, we've had very little in the REIT space. But other than that, there's nothing off limits. And yeah, you might say that the insurance industry, not a very exciting industry. Probably not a lot of smart 18-year-olds that are saying that their life's dream would be accomplished if they could run an insurance company someday. But there's some really profitable businesses and some businesses that can spread their risk so broadly that as a business, it's not a very risky business and they earn pretty good returns. So we don't shy away from industries that you might call typical value industries. They tend to trade at lower PEs. Nobody's going to argue they're the best businesses in the world. You probably even have sell targets that are a little bit of a discount to the market. But if they're cheap enough, those names can make really good investments.
Okay, and I've picked two companies that might kind of fit into those sort of traditional value type categories from the list of companies on the website, Delta and General Motors, GM. Looking back over sort of the last 10 years, Delta and GM are somewhat similar in that the returns haven't looked great over the last decade, but it feels like maybe something, and I saw this in one of your letters, that something structurally is a little different. What makes those investments different today than they were a decade ago?
Yeah, Delta is relatively new for us. We bought it last year. So we bought it because the returns on the stock hadn't been very good for a decade. General Motors, unfortunately, we experienced the decade as a shareholder. So that's not as happy a story for us. But at General Motors, first, what we missed a decade ago was how going through bankruptcy at the great financial crisis had changed their balance sheet, dramatic write-down in fixed assets. So it was structural that they had to spend a lot more for a long time on capital expenditures than depreciation to get to the point where the balance sheet reflected the real costs of the fixed assets. So the company was effectively overstating its cash flow dramatically. The earnings were overstating cash flow. We were slow to catch on to that. Then they compounded their problems by using most of the cash flow they were generating to invest in adjacent businesses that they really weren't very good at managing. About a year ago, the company went through what I think could go down as the most important change in their history, where they said, where we're going to take the cash flow the company generates and we're going to return it to shareholders because the stock is just too cheap. And you had this stock at $45 earning $9 a share, and they said, we're going to buy back at least 20% of our outstanding shares this year. And they bought back like 25% last year. And they said, and this isn't a one-time shot. We're not harming our balance sheet to do this. We're using the cash we're generating. If the stock doesn't respond, we're going to do it next year. And if it doesn't respond, we'll do it the year after that. Well, if they can keep net income flat and the share base goes down by 25% a year, GM's going to be one of the best growth stocks in our portfolio. The risk is anytime repurchase is such an important part of the story is, will they give up on it at the wrong time? You know, we've seen management teams before that have kind of drawn a line in the sand and said, our stock is just too cheap here. We're going to put money into repurchase. And then like 2 years later, they'll say, well, that didn't really work. So we're going to try something else. And I will always ask them, I'm like, can you go a little deeper into, you know, what do you mean it didn't work? Did it not reduce the denominator? And what they mean by it didn't work was they didn't get the stock market reaction that they had anticipated. And I think the CFO at General Motors is to his core, committed to this strategy that if cash flow goes back to shareholders and we can at least keep the business flat, maybe grow it a little bit, there's no way to lose. And that is radically different than what we've seen in GM the past 20 years. Delta is a little bit different of a story. Stock last year had gotten down to about 40. It was earning $10 a share. All consumer surveys showed it as everybody's favorite major airline. We had been concerned about the economy airlines and what they were doing to pricing structure across the industry. But a lot of those companies were kind of falling on hard times. Things weren't going very well for them. As the major airlines had figured out how to respond with selling a few rows in the back of the plane at the same price as the economy providers. So we thought the structure of the industry was getting better. Delta was the preferred carrier for most customers, selling at 4x earnings, an industry that we all rely on. Travel is going to be important. And a management there, like GM, that believes that if they don't have high return organic growth opportunities, the capital is going to go back to the shareholders.
Yeah, just taking a look at that General Motors shares outstanding chart, it's started to drop pretty quickly here over the last 12, 18 months, it looks like.
Yeah, when I said to the CFO, said, if you keep this up for 5 years, we're going to be the only shareholder. He said, no, you're not, because I'm not selling mine.
Yeah, that's, I guess that's a good situation for any other shareholders.
Clearly that won't happen. Yeah. Nobody has to worry that Oakmark's going to be 100% owner of an illiquid stock. But that's just a way to demonstrate if they keep their earnings at the level they're at, and if the share base continue, if they take a fifth of the shares out 5 years in a row, the stock can't stay at $45 a share.
We should have asked this during the process part, but how much, I guess, effort and time does the team dedicate to trying to understand the why behind a discount to the valuation? Like, is that a big part of the process? Why is it trading cheaply? Who's kind of understanding the other side of the argument?
Well, it depends. We do like to understand the other side of the argument. It's one of the reasons that when we present a new idea, we have somebody who's presenting the other side of the argument. You want to know what you're fighting against, but we're not really concerned unless the argument against is an inept management team that will never be able to maximize the value of the assets and just has a hard stop that they would never consider offers for selling the company. You know, if something like that's the reason for the discount, we don't want anything to do with that either. We're not intentional activist investors. You know, we go into companies because we think management is aligned with us. Every once in a while, when we find out that we were wrong on that assumption, by far the overwhelming majority of the times that happens, we just sell our position and move on. But every once in a while, we will privately engage with the management, with the board, try to press for change. But we would only do that if we think that that specific company is priced significantly better than what our next available alternative would be.
Okay, makes sense. And speaking of, I guess, management alignment, your team is typically investing in large cap companies. And so typically, not always, you're probably not getting owner operators because maybe these businesses have been around for quite a long time. So there isn't an exact alignment there. So for a non-founder led company, are there common incentives that you like the management teams to have, or is it company dependent?
Well, I think first, it's human nature that people do what's in their personal economic interest. And if you're a CEO of a large company, your annual earnings stream is probably going to go up if the company is bigger. And I think that's the core of the problem for a lot of managements that just grow through acquisition. They issue their own stock. And even though the company's getting a lot bigger, there's not much change in the per share business value. That's an impediment to getting CEOs to do what GM is doing and say, we're going to grow by shrinking the number of outstanding shares as opposed to really trying to make the scale of the business much larger. So what we want to make sure is that the economic incentives for the management team are tied enough to performance metrics, equity metrics, stock price, options, so that they will make more money if we make more money. And we don't want to be in the company that doesn't have denominators on their performance bonuses. If it's just, if you hit this sales metric or this earnings metric, you know, you get 100% of your salary and bonus. It's easy to get there by making dumb acquisitions. If there's a denominator and it's like a return on equity or an earnings per share, then we're much more interested and would consider that being much more in alignment with us. So a big part of our process is trying to understand management motivation, what their past successes or failures have been, because we believe that if that person was at another company before they joined this one, it's probably a strong indication of how they'll act at the new company. And we like to see managements that were willing to sell divisions when there is a strategic buyer that would pay more than it could ever be worth under the ownership of the company they're managing, or that will return capital to shareholders when organic growth opportunities aren't present, or will consider a bid for the whole company if you get a strategic buyer that can make it worth more than a discounted cash flow would make it worth as an independent. So, you know, even though when I list the three things of being cheap relative to value, value that's growing, and aligned management, that doesn't mean that management is the least important of those. In a lot of ways, I think it's the most important.
I was listening to a discussion you had with a previous guest on the show as well, John Rotante, and you mentioned the story of coming in as a young analyst and saying, you know, I really like the management team. And I believe it was your boss at the time said, I don't want to hear you say that until you've seen however many management teams. I guess, could you retell that story a bit? And do you think you've gotten quicker at detecting management teams that you like over time?
So back then, one of the most efficient ways to meet management teams, learn about companies, was to go to their roadshow lunches. So you'd see companies that were selling new shares. Maybe it was an IPO, maybe it was a secondary. The CEO would typically be there. You'd be at a lunch meeting with, you know, 8 or 10 other institutional investors, and you could get exposure to that person. And I went to this lunch and I came back and I told my boss that I was really impressed by this guy. And Peter, my boss, you know, this is back in the old days, you know, lights up his cigar, leans way back, takes a deep drag on it, and he says, don't you think every CEO is going to be impressive? How do you think he got the job? He said, I don't want to hear another word from you about whether you like or don't like a management till you've met 100 of them. After you've seen 100 of them, then you can start to tell me if you think you're seeing outliers. Until then, not a peep. And I was exceedingly humbled by it. But with 40 years of hindsight, he was 100% right. You almost never meet a CEO that doesn't have great public speaking skills, that doesn't have an IQ significantly above average. You know, it's like the pyramid they talk about in sports, where you've got all these kids playing youth sports. By the time you get up to college, you're at the very top of the pyramid, and you can barely even see pro at the top of it. You know, these people start out in companies that have thousands of employees, and they rise to the top. It's because they're charismatic, they can speak well, they're really smart. And that's really not enough to distinguish a management team. That's kind of table stakes. And I think today I can rate managements much more quickly on how focused they are on their shareholders, as opposed to, you know, maybe their own legacy or making the company bigger. Yeah, it is meeting 100 of them that is what helps you decide if somebody's top decile or not.
All right, couple wrap-up questions here. First one, what would you say has been your biggest investing mistake that you've made over your career? And what lessons did you take away from that?
You know, it's funny. There's so many mistakes. If you define the mistake as you bought something that went down, you know, we owned a lot of banks going into the GFC. We were oblivious to how much credit risk there was on their balance sheet and took way too much comfort in the history of home prices not going down. There are a lot of companies that we mistook cyclical improvement for secular improvement, and at the top of the cycle projected that that line would keep going up and to the right. But when you think about mistakes only as the ones you lost money on, you can never lose more than you invest. And the biggest mistake, I think, would probably be Apple. And it's a stock we bought in, what was the year? I've got it written down here. 2009, we bought Apple. It was selling at a discount PE to the market. We were all Apple customers, loved their phones, thought that switching costs were very high. Presentation by a senior analyst was great. We put Apple into our portfolio at a small position size, partly because we were so concerned about how are we going to explain this great growth stock in a portfolio that people expect to see General Motors and Delta. Nobody ever says, wow, you're a value investor. How can you own General Motors? They say, how can you own Apple? And we were way more cautious than we should have been on Apple. We owned the stock for 12 years. During those 12 years, it never sold at enough of a premium to the market to make us think we would have to sell the stock. It went up 30-fold. The difference in our portfolio, had it been a 2% position going in instead of 1, would make up for 30 mistakes of getting wiped out on companies that we bought that ended up being real duds. So I think the real lesson there was when companies clearly meet your criteria, you can't let anything get in the way of appropriately position sizing them. And I think if you look at the way Oakmark's been managed the past 15 years, we've learned a lot from that Apple lesson. We bought Google just 2 years after we bought Alphabet, and we paid about $12 a share for it. It's still one of our largest holdings. And we did not shy away at all during that time period from a value investor having Alphabet as its largest position. I think we've been leaders in the value investment industry for buying companies where intangibles have become their largest asset. And you can't see through a price to book or a PE ratio how cheap the company is. I'm not sure we would have gotten as far as fast as we did on that had we not made the underinvestment in Apple that we did.
That's super valuable lesson. Last question for you. What is one piece of advice you would give to someone entering the investment industry today?
I think if you're going to succeed in this business, it becomes all-encompassing. So you better really love it. I mean, any thought that this can be an 8-to-5 job that you go home at night and you don't still think about, you know, one more question you could ask a manager or one more contact that you could make a check on a company. If you're in a store, you're thinking about which company makes this product and does it look like they're over-inventoried in it. If you're going to be good at this business, you can't turn it off. And because of that, you need to really love it. And if you think that you can contain, you need to have your job contained, you should pick a different profession. But if you love it and you truly love it and you can't help yourself from getting into this profession, it's a great line of work. You get to work with really smart people. The advice to those people is read everything you can, listen to people that are experienced in the business. You know, the ability to go on your phone and hear podcasts like this with lots of people who've had really successful 30, 40, 50 year careers, and it's free. And that didn't exist 40 years ago. So your ability to learn just keeps growing and growing. And you have to love that. You have to have insatiable curiosity. Learn accounting. Read everything you can read. Don't worry if the first job isn't your dream job. You know, in some ways, I consider myself lucky that my first job was 180 degrees away from what a dream job in this industry was, because I learned about how different a lot of the other investment organizations are. I think for somebody who grows up inside of Harris Oakmark, it's hard for them to even imagine what life would be like in a typical insurance company's investment department. So, you know, don't freak out if that first job isn't the best job. This is an outward facing job. You talk to a lot of people, you meet a lot of other investors. You'll get the opportunity to make the switch to something that's a better long-term fit. But if you don't absolutely love it, do yourself a favor and, you know, find something you can do a better job containing the 8 to 5.
All right. That is going to do it for today. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to this episode of AUM. I'd like to remind listeners that the AUM podcast is for informational and educational purposes only. All opinions expressed on the show by hosts or guests are solely their own and do not constitute formal advice or recommendation. Thank you a ton to Bill for joining the show, and thank you all again for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Ryan. This was fun.